We are the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio. Well, let's just say the 6 o'clock news will never be the same again. The days of Walter Cronkite and three network channels has long passed. Well, journalism has morphed into news, opinion, and ideological rants, all passed off as unbiased, honest news. This is Malcolm Out Loud here. So your search continues for the Out Loud truth. I get it. Well, here it won't be just the news. It'll be how we discuss the news. A drive time show you can count on weekdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We call it Nozzle. World news, political talk, stories that impact your health. Honor our heroes, stories that'll inspire you. What you'll hear next is the heartbeat of the people. The hottest topics, the news stories that trend. It's time, friends, for a new stream of consciousness. It's Nozzle.
All the predictions about blue waves, red responses, and all the conjecture, you know, kind of got proved out. And what do we got? It looks like we've got a bit of a mixed bag, and probably the most interesting place where that mixed bag occurred is the state of California, the contentious state of California, the leader of the nation in terms of weird things happening, or as we who live here like to call it, La La Land. Okay, so hey Jennifer, you work in, you've been doing a lot of work in campaigns for both issues and candidates throughout this primary thing. And I want to get your thoughts on probably, you know, the big race and how it turned out. But we're going into November in California for a governor's election, coming out of an open primary, which people were worried about one-party lockouts. And here we are. Gavin Newsom, it's a Newsom-Cox, mm-hmm. right? One Republican, one Democrat. Cox was endorsed by Donald Trump a few days before the election. And so your thoughts, you know, is Cox riding the Trump train on a red wave in California?
I don't know that I'd put it exactly like that. Obviously, we know that, or I don't know if it's obvious, Cox was not a voter for Trump in 16. He voted Gary Johnson, interestingly. And I don't know how many of his people are true Trump people. From what I saw, most of the real Trump, the Trump train riders were on the Travis Allen side of the equation. And they were not happy at all when Trump came out and endorsed John Cox. So I think that there will be some of that. Hopefully those voters will not be disaffected. But I think that Cox, I think what the reason why Trump endorsed him is because Cox is a businessman like Trump, and smart money and investing, the way that businessmen look at things. Trump looked at the finances of the two and the operations and said, all right, I'm gonna go with this one, even though Travis Allen's people are far more Trump loving.
Okay. So it's essentially the observation there is, you know, here's another outsider coming into government, and mm-hmm. And Trump likes that. So Kelly, yes. Gavin Newsom, you've met the guy up close. Your impressions of the man trying to run to replace Jerry Brown?
Yeah. Oh, I have an impression for sure. And, you know, when I met Gavin, we hosted a really large event together, not by choice, just not because I'm friends with them. And I said, hey, let's host an event together. We were put together. And this was in, I want to say, maybe 2006 or 7, something. It was a while ago. And I really wasn't involved in politics at all. I had no idea what was going on in the world. So, and the reason why I'm saying that is when I walked away with my impression of him, it had nothing to do with like where I stand politically. It was, so I'll just tell you the story. So we're up on stage, and he and I both had to do an introduction in front of thousands of people. And I didn't know what I was going to say. Right. And so he was sitting next to me, he was talking to me, and he goes, oh, don't even worry about it. It's total BS, except you use those two words. And he goes, just make it up, you know, say what they want to hear. And when it came to his time, he had to kind of be there, but he goes, he kind of tapped me and he goes, watch this, watch this. And he's laughing and he's like, just follow my lead. I mean, and the way he spoke to me was, he's such an empty suit. And he got up there and he was like, and this was for a gay pride, like 5K walk or something like that. And he just got up there and said, "We love you. You're the, you know, the heart of the city." I mean, just like cliche after cliche. And when he came back to the seat, he's like, "See, that's easy. Just make it up." Oh, and I thought, gosh. Oh my God. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, Gavin Newsom up for governor. Ay, ay, ay. Well, let's move on to a few other races.
Yeah.
Jan, Feinstein versus De Leon. You kind of get the impression, you know, this is San Francisco versus the provincial Californian race. I mean, is this Californians versus Californios? Are we about to get a lesson in, you know, California orange growing history all over again in this race come November?
I really think that Dianne Feinstein just walks away with this one. I mean, she's old, so unless something happens where she just can't serve, she walks away with it. I mean, she mopped the floor with De Leon in the primary, and Republicans aren't any more fond of De Leon than Democrats are.
Which is true.
And scarily, as I've seen with Jerry Brown, Dianne Feinstein has become the voice of reason sometimes in the Democrat Party. Now, I mean, not that I agree with her reasoning, but comparatively to Kamala, De Leon, you know, Feinstein has surprised me a few times with her position. So, and from the scuttlebutt I hear, there's a lot of dirt that's to come out on De Leon. So,
I think, well, I mean, you know, he is Mr. Sanctuary State on top of everything.
Right.
Else. So
exactly.
That makes it's hard to build a constituency there, particularly, and you're right, against a long time serving U.S. senator that has a track record of having to have been both on the far edge and a center edge of the work of her party over a long period of time. I want to expand, you know, like, so there, let's go national for a second on this. So there are 84 competitive seats up for grabs in the House, all of which have Republicans and Democrats going for it. So there's a battle for the House between now and November. Jennifer, what's your read on that?
Overall, I still think that the Republicans keep that they don't lose enough seats to really make a difference. I really think there's actually a chance that they can flip a seat or two in California from Dem to Republican. And I don't think that they're going to lose any Republican seats. And that's kind of the key.
Yeah.
If that stays the same, it doesn't matter nationwide.
All right. Well, I mean, you know. So Kelly, I didn't vote for Maxine again. Just, I mean, letting you know. You know that I know it's a violation of the secrecy of the ballot box, but I'll come clean. I went to the polls. I went there in person. I voted, and I punched a name other than.
Yeah.
Than her. And then I came out and a whole bunch of my friends going, "Well, how come you didn't file and like get your name in there? It's a page and a half of people running for these offices."
Gosh. Right. Well, Dennis, why didn't you get your name in time?
I don't know. My muse was on my case and I didn't listen.
I have the same question. I think I want to do a campaign for Dennis in 2020.
Yep.
Oh, there we go. So here.
See, yeah. the two of us are going to gang up on you and make this happen because.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Could you imagine? I mean, that would be the best thing that ever happened to California. You should go.
Oh, there. Yeah.
Well, okay. So, like, I will say this, you know, as the first thing there, I actually live in this district. She doesn't.
Yeah. Exactly. But didn't she represent another district too?
She lives over in some rich part of town.
Thought she lives in Highland Park.
Yeah, she does. I mean, you know, which is nowhere near Hawthorne. So, right. You know, yeah, it kind of is.
She just collects her bribes there and then takes them to
Right.
Well, you know, can we say that on the air? Okay. Well, we can.
Yeah.
We can question that on the air. Yeah. Yeah. Well, her husband is, you know, they're big real estate people in California. You know, they're kind of like the Feinsteins. You know, they got like contract after contract, and you know, these are not poor people.
I'm shocked.
As much as the impression that they make in this world. And people listening to this in the rest of the country are going, oh my God, that place really is La La Land.
Yeah,
speaking of other La La Land stuff, I saw a, I'd like to get both your impression on this. I saw that Koch is retiring. And, you know, so the Texas conservative politics money. Yeah, and he says he's retiring from that and from political life as well. What do you think that means in terms of, you know, like, where does the conservative agenda go in the future? As he and his brother were a force of money behind a lot of things happening for the last 2-3 decades. So, you know, like, what does that mean? Kelly, start with you. What do you think?
I'd have to defer to Jen on this one. I mean, to me, it seems like there's a lot of money that's going to be lost for the Republican Party. But I'm also not that deep in behind the scenes of politics. I'd like to know Jen's opinion on this.
Even though he's getting out of it, I think, you know, full disclosure, my son did a summer in D.C. as one of their interns. So our family has benefited, I suppose. But the institutions that he and his brother set up are still, they're in place already, and there's probably longstanding funding agreements for whatever their nonprofits. So I think that there's still going to be a big influence. And, you know, despite liberals saying that all of us get all this money, everyone who's involved in conservative politics, I really wish I had.
Yeah, there you go. All right.
So there's no checks coming.
Yeah. Well, okay. So the bottom line there is the Koch Empire has set its legacy up, which basically means it will be continue to be able to fight the open society empire of George Soros, so, you know, for time to come. Even though, you know, Soros seems to have more of his problems coming. The Italians hate him. Everybody in Eastern Europe is throwing his foundation out.
I mean, I haven't done any research to know that that's factually 100% true, but just from my understanding of how things have worked historically, that it's still just going to keep on. Maybe not as bombastically, but hey, the next generation could be more bombastic. Who knows?
That's true. Well, you never know. I mean, you know, if the trusts are in place, that's the way it goes. So people have been listening. It's time for some intros. And I'll let you introduce yourselves. Take about a minute each. Let's start with Jennifer.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Van Laar. I'm a Southern California native, but I lived in exile in the South for 20 years, returned back one of the crazy ones that believes that California can be saved and that we just need to get the actual conservatives out, have the right candidates, and we can turn this country around starting with California. I write for Red State, town hall columnist, and work in political messaging.
Wow. Okay. I'm impressed. Kelly, your turn. Take a minute and tell the world who you are, you know, even though they probably already recognize you just from your voice.
No. Okay. My name is Kelly Carlson. I'm originally from Minneapolis, Minnesota, but I've lived in California for 25 years. Just recently moved to San Diego from LA and love it. I am an actress. I was on a television show called Nip Tuck for about 8 years. And now I'm a Navy wife. And I fill my time following Dennis around. And also, I work a little bit with the Center for Security Policy with Frank Gaffney.
Well, there you go. Well, there you go. So that's commentators for today. This is Dennis Santiago. It's Thursday. And today marks the first time I am regularly doing Nozzle on Thursdays. So, you know, welcome to a different voice version of what's going on, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the program. We finish up one last thought from both of you before we move off of California politics. Blue wave, red tide. What do you see between now and November in terms of the nature of the fight? Just take a minute each. Kelly, you first.
My palms are sweating. That's how I feel. I'm so nervous. Like, I'm super excited. Wait, I'm sorry. Are you talking about California?
Yeah.
Are you talking about nation?
Either one. I mean, you know, between now and November, fight's on, clearly. You know, sorry, people are going to be watching Cali because, you know, we seem to fight feisty here, but,
well, yeah. I'm super excited about, California. I mean, the fact that, you know, Cox is on, I want to like get out there and help him, you know, it's really exciting to possibly have a Republican governor again. And what Jen said, you know, made me feel a lot better about not losing seats. So thank you for enlightening me on that.
Yeah. Jennifer is a trench operator, you know. How's the fight gonna go? How messy do you think we're looking between now and November?
Oh, messy. It's already started with the messy. It's gonna get worse. But I think overall, I mean, the biggest thing is going to be old-fashioned politicking. We've got to get our people out knocking doors, our candidates out talking to people. The get out the vote strategy, that the ground game that's virtually been non-existent for decades in California and has led to this, has to be re-energized. And I think we do that on a congressional district level. If the GOP, California GOP, can partner with those congressional candidates and get the ground game going, we can really turn it around. The numbers are there for the Republicans to really do great things this fall. They just have to choose that they want to.
There you go. All right. So there's the report from the left coast for the day, and we'll be right back.
Well, the Out Loud perspective awaits you in life, love, politics, a healthy lifestyle, your faith, personal development, and living an out loud life on AmericaOutloud.com. Blitzer News and Entertainment Network, where you can listen 24/7 on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
And we're back with Nozzle on Thursday. So, time for the international news. Today's kind of a big day in terms of Korea, right? The summit is coming. It's June 12th. Lots and lots of in the background discussions today on the docket at the White House. Prime Minister Abe from Japan is meeting with President Trump at midday today or mid-afternoon today. And then following that, there is a meeting with Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State. And this all leads up to the goings-on that will wind up in Singapore. The U.S. is gathering people that will be showing up. Kim Jong-un's favorite American will be in Singapore. You know, that would be Dennis Rodman. You know, that came out the other day, and it looks like this summit is coming together with a lot of you know, lower level officials. The rough spots have been bumped out of the way, and things are moving along, which is, when you think back at it, you know, a year ago, the talk was, you know, we're getting ready to go to war. And so Kelly, I mean, you know, your husband, Dan, mm-hmm. has been deployed in Korea. And when he went there, it was in that time when Kim Jong-un was throwing missiles all over the planet, making noise and being belligerent. And in the year that he's been there, so much has changed, you know, and, you know, you've been talking to him, you know, pretty much every day, I would guess, going back and forth. Perspective-wise, you know, we've been watching all these things happen from the outside looking in, but, you know, from the point of view of being married to somebody that's been there and seen his mission evolve right in front of his eyes over the last year, you know, mm-hmm. what's your impression of what's going on? You know, how does this impact you?
Well, at first, in the very beginning, obviously, when he was talking about Guam and all of that, I was very nervous, especially nervous after you explained to me why his aggression towards Guam was so serious. I would never have known that. Maybe you can explain that. So, yeah, I was really nervous because that's what Dan is there to do. And I know that we wouldn't, I don't think the U.S. would necessarily attack from the sky. So that makes me more nervous, right? That's where Dan comes in. So, but I will tell you this, what has calmed me down and has made me feel better is the way Trump has handled this. Because someone who studies psychology quite a bit in dealing with psychopaths, I know dictators respond to self-preservation. That's what they respond to. So, and that's what he's responding to, self-preservation. And Trump approached him in the proper way. Yes, diplomatic, you know, diplomacy, but also you've got to be aggressive with him. I mean, it's the only way he's going to respond. So I have very high hopes for this summit. And I very much feel like this is going to have a positive outcome. I could be totally wrong, but it's just what my gut tells me. And knowing how, I mean, I don't know Trump that well. I know him a little bit, but I've seen him, you know, in a business setting. And I think he's a very diplomatic negotiator. And what I mean by that is he is present in the room. He is looking at people in the eye and he wants it to be an equitable experience. He's not there to strong arm someone necessarily. He wants the other side to walk away happy. And that's really important. And that's why I feel comfortable going into this summit. I think Kim Jong-un will respond positively to Trump.
Well, he certainly responded positively so far, you know.
Yeah.
When you really look at, the number of hawkish characters that have emerged and have hoped that this thing wouldn't come off on both sides, you know, quite mm-hmm. honestly, have been numerous. And both of these leaders have knocked them down and, you know, and basically shown leadership to their own people, saying, no, this is what we want. Jennifer, you know, from the point of view of, so the West Coast was kind of always, you know, one of the juicy target for, you know, the Korean menace, so to
yes.
speak. And, you know, we suffered through the, other people in the United States, you know, basically tongue in cheek, taking maps of California and renaming all our cities Guam. and it's humor. It took the edge off of what yeah. was a fairly tense situation, and from the point of view of you've got kids, right?
And mm-hmm. and I have two boys that are age that could be drafted if anything.
Yeah,
as extreme as that happened,
and that's kind of the perspective I wanted to get from you is like, so you see this, and this is in current times, what's happening in Korea is to me no less different, or no less significant than say the falling of the Berlin Wall, right? You know, it's Korea has been a key pin in the matrix of tension of East Asia ever since the end of the Korean War or even before. Mm-hmm. And it's all falling by the wayside. I remember around the time that Dan deployed, I was teaching a class in at Camp Pendleton to a bunch of Marines who were part of the 11th Marine Expeditionary Force, which was the backup force that would go to Korea to fight if a war started. And these kids all had the same question for me, and they, you know, at the end of the day, after shooting with them for an entire day, they became comfortable with me. The only question they had for me was, sir, if we go to war with Korea, a lot of us are going to die, aren't we? And I said, yeah, unfortunately that is the reality. There is no way around it. Wars yeah. like that turn young men like you into meat.
Yeah.
And that it's seems to be going away. I mean, you know, it's like from a mother's perspective, you know, like your sons may not have to get the run the risk of being drafted and run into war. What do you think?
I hope not. I really hope not. And you brought up the Berlin Wall and Reagan, and I live right at the base of the Reagan Library, and I was
Right. That's true. Yeah. You voted there, didn't
Actually,
you?
I voted there. Week?
Yeah.
On the anniversary of his death, and that's what was weird, was walking up, and there's you literally walk up where the voters' parking is. You walk up and you go to the back of where the memorial is, where he and Nancy are buried. And there's one sign that says memorial site, and it has the arrow. And then the sign below it said vote. So I was telling some people I was working with, I texted them the picture, and they said, I haven't looked, but the vote arrow points right, correct? it did, thankfully. But so I was up there actually last Friday in a program that a community program I'm part of, and we're talking about the Berlin Wall. And we had a VIP tour from a woman who I call the original bad, I don't know if I can say ASS on your show, but she was the original one. She was an Air Force veteran.
Badass.
She retired as a colonel in the Air Force. And this woman was in her 70s. So you know that she was a trailblazer in that. That she gave a VIP tour, and we were talking about the Reykjavik summit and how Gorbachev wanted us to give up SDI. And Reagan said, no, that's a defensive thing. That doesn't come into play unless you aggress against us. So we're not going to give up our defense, and walked away. And I'm sure you both know all that, but just in case our listeners don't. And he walked away, and everyone was ticked off that thinking that he gave up the opportunity for peace. But that actually led to an actual opportunity for real peace instead of being bullied into something. And then Saturday night, I was at a dinner where Andy Puzder spoke, who was the Department of Labor nominee and a former Carl's Jr. CEO. And he was talking about Iran and Syria and the Obama failures there, and just saying, you know, they kept saying they're negotiating. But the problem is, if you don't have things that you're not going to cave on, if you don't have certain things that are just, this is my immovable position, then you're not negotiating. If you're not ready to walk away on those issues, you're not negotiating. And that all really came into play with my thoughts on North Korea. And I really don't like to compare Trump to Reagan in many ways, but I think that there's a potential here that this could be like Reagan solved the Cold War, and we have somewhat good relations with Russia now, that Korea, that could be the same thing. Instead of containment for the last 50 years and a potential, like just always that threat looming over us, that we could actually resolve something now.
Yeah. Well, I see it the same way. And I'll amplify that a little bit. So at the Reagan Library, the old Air Force One is there. Air Force One, I talked to Air Force One once in my entire life. It was parked at Reykjavik. A conference call that lasted 2.5 hours, at the end of which Edward Severnod said, yes, we'll sign it. That's I see what Trump is doing here to be as pivotal. The world is going to change directions because of the work that's being done now. Not just him, but, you know, a lot of other people are doing it, because it's a big team effort in order to make something like this happen. But, I see it going that way.
Well, Dennis, they're literally following your playbook on this.
Well, look, I made suggestions in writings, right? But that's basically, they're observational. I think a lot of other people who are also very smart picked up on the exact same playbook. But I think that speaks to the fact that there are still a lot of true patriots and true visionaries that have been hidden away in government that have come out and have started to do their work again as a that's actually an ode to Donald Trump's ability to manage and run things like a business. And the system started working again. I'm very excited by the fact that it did. And, you know, so it followed basically formulas that were very, the stuff that I've written over the last 8 months on this subject of Korea are really, they're echoes of the same kinds of things that I wrote back in the 1980s for the Reagan administration in terms of things to do with, of all things, the Strategic Defense Initiative. You know, so we're following those same kinds of playbooks, and you know what? It really works. You get world peace out of it. You know, like I what can I say? You know, a little bit later, you know, talk about world peace. You know, a little bit later, we'll talk about swimsuit competitions, and which is where you say you like, well, you want world peace. But hey, real quick, I need to change subjects on you right now and get your impressions on something else that's going on, just because this is national issues. So the G7 summit is going to go off in Canada, and there's a whole bunch of things having to do with, and it's about trade, right, and trade and tariffs. The word is that President Trump is going to go to the G7 summit, and he's prepared to be hard-nosed about the negotiations that America is doing with regard to trade and tariffs, and in particular, hard-nosed with the Canadians and with the Europeans when this summit goes off. It's interesting to note that, according to Reuters reporting on things, that the U.S. trade deficit is at a seven-month low. It's been going down and down and down as U.S. exports have started to succeed around the world. China, interestingly enough, the other day offered to buy $70 billion worth of U.S. goods in order to improve the trade balance and avoid tariffs from the U.S. So there's the Chinese, the other real big economy in the world, kind of pushing things along and saying, hey, no, we want to cooperate with the U.S. The opposite side of that is the Mexicans, and Mexico apparently is preparing to levy all kinds of tariffs on the United States. But that's not the, you know, but I can understand that because it's Mexico, right? You know, there's a lot of stuff that has gone back and forth, and it's probably the biggest labor pool movement thing that's going on, in an industry pool differential that is really easy for U.S. industry to cross borders with. But here's the weird one that I wanted to really get your reaction to. So it turns out on trades and tariffs, the European Union and the Canadians and the Mexicans have found an ally to resist President Trump and the administration's work in trades and tariffs. And it turns out it's the Republican Party. The GOP in Congress is siding with these other countries under the argument that that's a better interest of the United States. I'd like to get both of your opinion as to whether or not you agree with the GOP wanting to side with the EU as opposed to the US. And I'm going to start with Jennifer.
No, don't start with me.
Yes, please.
What? You don't want to say?
I want to hear the words of wisdom that Kelly has first.
All right. Well, okay. Yeah. Well, you know, okay. No, I'm good with it, but you know, like we'll frame it. Okay, diabolical Kimber Henry. What does that evil mind from Nip Tuck say about the GOP twisting the plot?
Well, first of all, Kimber would be a Democrat, so we're going to leave her out of it. Okay, I am no economist, and this is so far from a topic of that I understand. I'm disheartened by it. However, I know that I don't know enough necessarily to form an opinion because I know nothing about trade. And I trust his ability in business, right? I trust his instincts. Now, that's just kind of a blind trust. I'll totally admit that. But there must be a very good reason why the GOP is putting their foot down. So I would defer to you, Dennis. This is something I would call Dennis and say, can you explain this to me, please?
All right. Okay. Anyway. Jennifer, I mean, you know, like, I mean, you do a lot of work with GOP people, right? I mean, you know, and the California Republican Party is very neocon like in its nature, which is really, you know, this side of the GOP.
True.
So why is this more never Trump than, or is, or
I don't think, or is I really there... don't think that plays into it. And disclaimer, I'm more of a libertarian-ish. I'm officially no party preference. And my son has his bachelor's in economics. That's the one that did the Koch internship. Right. So he's the better one to ask this. But in general, Republicans are against, we're for free trade, against tariffs. And but obviously, if another country is not being fair, or and it's not truly an open market, then obviously we have to take those kinds of things into consideration when we're creating our trade policy. And I don't really think it's never Trump. I think it's that probably a lot of these people, companies donate to the GOP and are saying our businesses are going to get screwed if this goes through. But like Kelly, I don't have an extreme. I mean, I know some things about economics, but I'm not an expert.
All right. Well, so, and I wanted to get both of your reactions to it, because
it's something I'd want to read a lot more about.
I mean, you know, like, you know, quite honestly, I do, you know, I could go ministerially detailed, in terms of all this kind of stuff, which would bore everyone to death.
Well, you and my son could have an amazing conversation on that. I would sit there with my eyes glazing over.
And most people do. And, you know, but I wanted your reaction to it from that perspective, because...
But we need to be able to explain. That's the thing. And that's where I come into play on issues that I do understand. And if I studied this enough, I'd be fine with it. But we need people that can communicate the things like this, that even people that are involved in politics feel a little bit, you know, skittish about. We need to be able to explain that to the common man on the street. Yes. And say, why does this affect me? We can't, yes. We have to find a way to do that. Otherwise, we're going to continue to just not be able to get our agenda forward.
That's so correct.
Yeah. And, you know, so like, the short answer to all of this is in street talk is that the U.S. has really exported a lot of jobs and imported a lot of unemployment from the rest of the world for decades. This started back in the 1990s, and it's only in very recent times have we really, from a governmental perspective, began to try to reverse that. And, you know, to be fair, the Trump administration is carrying on a mission that was recognized and tried unsuccessfully by the previous administration. The Obama administration was trying to do something about trade deficits as well, but they never were able to succeed at being able to turn the tide. Everything that they tried, the other countries were able to get around, essentially, you know, because this is a national problem. And they weren't able to outmaneuver the competition, so to speak. And what's actually happening here, as you see this going, is that you know, the Trump administration actually does know how to outmaneuver the competition, and it knows how to co-opt the other parties into working. I mean, you know, an extreme success with the other large economy on the planet, which is China, which is really the only other single country that approaches the U.S. in terms of GDP. And so these other countries are, you know, what they're really doing is they're trying to preserve what they've gotten out of the last few decades, and they're trying to hang on to stuff. And the hard explanation at the moment is the economics of, if you go through with the plan of resetting the boundaries, how does that work to the better of everyone else? And that hasn't really been well explained, not just to the common man, but it hasn't really been well explained to the governments of these other nations as well, you know, because they've been having easy living. And what the U.S. Yeah. is asking for now is that we have fair living. And so that's kind of a toughie. We'll be right back with the next segment of Nozzle.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa. Award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
We're going to talk a little bit about culture for the rest of the hour, and because there have been several things that have been evolving in the last week or so that I think deserve a little bit better attention. You know, harkening back to the EU, I don't know how many of you have kept up with this, but in the European Union, gay rights has it's run into some weird things over there, in that if you consummate a marriage in, say, Belgium, it's not recognized in certain other Eastern European countries that are also part of the EU. So you've got essentially the European Union reflecting regional preferences and politics. Very, very different from one country to another, and it's causing problems over there, which is kind of interesting because, you know, you get the same kind of stuff going over here. In the last week, we've had the Supreme Court decision on cake, which generated its own narrow, the word narrow became, you know, like the big word on the internet the last couple of days of like what the people want. It's a 7-2 decision. How is it narrow? And what the Supreme Court said in the case of the bakery case was that you have to treat every interaction one at a time as an individual case. And it kind of goes either both ways, and that both parties have rights, which is, you know, goes back to the all people are created equal concept of the United States. At the same time, you've got other cultural things happening. But you know, let's just start with that for a second. From the point of view of, you know, your Supreme Court decision on cake, you agree with the way that they came out on it, that the Supreme Court basically says this is something that has to go back to being a nebulous argument that happens one at a time, and there's a lot more debate that has to occur before there's any real answer? Or, you know, like other people, they're basically looking for simple answers that are basically going, the Supreme Court got it wrong. They should have, like, declared that. Where's your thoughts on that? And Jennifer, I'm going to go back to you again first.
Okay, I agree with the way that they rolled on it, and that interactions should be one at a time. And like a lot of people pointed out, like the people in that case were not saying that gay people couldn't come in and buy things there. It's not that they refused to serve them. It's that they didn't want to use their artistic talents to depict something they don't agree with. And I think that that does have to be on a case-by-case basis. But we do need to make sure that we're not allowing people to get away with any kind of bigotry, even toward conservatives. I have a friend on Twitter who, his name's Steven Cruiser. He wrote something critical of a new Twitter policy. He has over 300,000 Twitter followers, and that's how he advertises for his comedy and his writings and other appearances. They suspended his account for 4 days and would never answer why. Yeah. It would never give anything. They deleted everyone that he was following. He came back with the same number of followers, but he wasn't following anyone. So now people are starting to unfollow him because they don't realize what's going on, and they think he's just being a jerk that unfollowed them in the world of Twitter feelings. Wow. But there's no reason why they did it. They will not answer any questions why. And I think that it's just a selective targeting of conservatives or people critical. So, you know, conservatives do have a stake in the way that these kind of things are decided and litigated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kelly?
Yeah.
Cake.
Well, I want to say, Jennifer, you make a really good point, because I was sitting, this is such a fascinating topic, I think, but I was really, you know, thinking a lot about bigotry towards the conservatives, and you see so much of it, and their feet are never held to the fire. So I think you make a really good point about setting a precedence. With this topic, with cake, this is the First Amendment versus civil right. Do I have that correctly? Yeah.
Technically, they're kind of the same thing.
Well, yeah, but I mean, okay, so you have the First Amendment, and then, you know, the gay rights, wouldn't that fall under civil rights?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, so I think the Supreme Court got this correct, because I think this is not an easy answer at all. I mean,
yeah.
At all.
I agree with both of you in that I also think the Supreme Court got it right, and because that is their job. The job of the Supreme Court of the United States is to force America to pay attention to the fact that it's a complex nation, right? And ambiguous answers are the best way to do that. I'm totally in on that. It's interesting, Jennifer, you brought up the Twitter thing, because in terms of culture wars, while Twitterscape has and others in terms of arbitrarily impacting users has gone on, there's actually a really interesting story of culture wars within the industry itself, and that's Facebook versus WhatsApp, where Facebook has been migrating itself towards a culture that basically takes user information, mining it, and using it for advertising purposes. But a few years ago, they bought WhatsApp for like $22 billion. It's the single largest internet purchase, property purchase ever. And WhatsApp has the exact opposite culture of they value privacy over everything else, and they're sharing offices. And apparently, the culture war between them has gone down to the pettiness of one side complaining over the size of the other side's desks. The Facebook guys think that the WhatsApp desks are a little too large because they have more square footage than them. And then the other one is there's an argument over the design of the bathrooms on one in the WhatsApp section of Facebook versus the Facebook section, in that the WhatsApp guys wanted all of the bathroom stalls to have doors that extended down to the floor, which is very much in keeping with international privacy practices, as opposed to the Facebook guys that were going, well, you know, and it sounds like it's petty. And you got Mark Zuckerberg trying to like sort through this. The two original founders of WhatsApp have both left the company. And, you know, so there's culture war for you. And, you know, in an industrial scale. Now, on back to the people on the street, and then we have the coffee thing, right? You know, so you got like, then you get cake and coffee. This is, I'm definitely inviting you guys for cake and coffee today. And on the coffee side, you got Starbucks, right? Which is basically opening its doors and to anybody that comes in, you don't have to buy anything there anymore. Still haven't begun to see the fallout from whether or not the other companies that are competitors of Starbucks are going to go after them on quality of service. But after handling that, the guy that runs Starbucks quit. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, he resigns and says, I'm done. You know, I've finished my work here and I'm going to go on now. You guys handle it. So if you're going to take a stand like that and then leave your people without leadership, you know, compare and contrast that. Here's industrial leadership that's doing stuff like this. Facebook having to, you know, they're basically being forced into a position of having to compromise on everything. And which normally you would think would be the kinds of positions the government is being put into. And now it's industry that's being put into them. And government, the executive level anyway, is standing up on its own two feet. Like, is our culture now upside down? What do you think? You know?
Like which?
Well, both. I mean, you know, like, now government is standing on its own feet and industry is being wishy-washy.
Yeah.
How did we get to that?
Well, I mean, the executive branch standing on their own two feet, well, that's kind of a first, wouldn't you say?
Well, yeah.
Or at least first in a long time.
It's done it in the past, but I mean, you know, from a cultural standpoint, you know, very clearly, the whole social justice movement has shifted where it has emphasized what it's doing in the world out of, public space and into private space. And
yeah.
Remember, there's no voting in private space. You only have to influence one or two people to affect social change.
Yeah.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing for U.S. culture? Jennifer, you know, does that worry you?
Absolutely. I think what the reason is why industry is waffling is because of Twitter mobs. I mean, look at what happened with Roseanne Barr. Within an hour, she lost everything as far as her show, syndication, and over something that I believe was a misunderstanding. Obviously, it was a horrible comment, but, she said that she did not know Valerie Jarrett's race. Yeah. But there was no time for the point, though. I don't want to debate all of that, but the point being that there was no time for debate of what was right or wrong. There was no let's put you on suspension. They just bowed to the Twitter mob immediately.
Yep. And then you got no more swimsuits for Miss America. I'm going to let Kelly answer this one. You know, Kelly, you worked with pageants in the past. I think you actually worked with Donald Trump on a pageant in the past.
Yeah, I was a judge.
You were a judge.
Let's all make very clear.
Well, you've seen that game from the inside. There's another culture war thing going on. What's your impression of that?
I don't know. The jury's still out for me because I think both sides have a legitimate argument. I see nothing wrong with a beauty pageant. I guess maybe I'm superficial. I don't read that much into it. I think beauty is allowed to be celebrated. But I can't relate, but I can see the other argument of, maybe the swimsuit is demeaning. We need to evolve a little bit, the swimsuit portion. I think this started in Jersey, was it?
Yeah. And by the way, I don't look good in a swimsuit, so I'm fine with that. But then again, I probably wouldn't enter the contest anyway. I'm just putting that out there right now.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm not into pageants. It was fun to judge it. It's not my world, but I have nothing against it either. So I don't know where I stand. I don't know that I have a stance.
Okay.
That's probably a lame answer.
No, it's not. You sound like the Supreme Court. You gotta listen to both sides on a case by case basis.
Which is
kind of the theme of this particular segment is like, you're just reinforcing the first answer that you gave.
Well, and it reminds me a little bit about I forget what school it was that said anybody can try out to be a cheerleader. It doesn't matter if you're good or not. I mean, I think it's kind of stupid, but I also can understand their argument too. I want to find a position on this, right? Because I love debates, but I really, trying to be diplomatic in this, I really can't find my footing on this topic.
Got it. All right. Well, I'd like to ask your footing on a fairly serious topic, and then we'll go to predictions. Kate Spade, woman, depression. I just want your thoughts as human beings on that, Kelly.
Well, it's so sad. I feel terrible. David Spade is a longtime friend of mine. I don't know why I'm just throwing that out there, but I guess that would be my connection to this situation. And, it's hard to see when people are depressed sometimes. It really takes the people that are real close to individuals to keep their eye on these individuals, but at the same time, I know that caring for somebody that's maybe manic, depressive, or is a very, very difficult and draining task, and it can break people that are trying to help.
Yeah, so, that's true. Yeah.
And And so I don't want to come down on people for not seeing this coming. You know, I don't know the situation, but it's really, really sad that she felt like she had to do that. And she has a daughter and a husband and,
you know. Yeah. Jennifer, you got a thought?
Yeah. First, I totally agree with everything that Kelly said. And it's so hard. And especially when you know people, like they're back years ago, there was a young man in a church group that I was a leader in that had been struggling with depression. And then 1 week he was just seemed so much better and we're all so happy. And then a few days later committed suicide and we were all kicking ourselves. You know, what did we miss? And found that sometimes people, when they've made that final plan, they do seem happier because they're seeing that way out. But, and I've also have a friend, a very, very close friend that over the last 3 or 4 months has really, really struggled with suicidal problems. And I'm the person that gets the calls for that. And so I can't tell you the number of weekends I've worried about finding out that that person had taken their life and they have young children. And I'd say, you know, think about your kids, think about this. They would be devastated. And their thought was that, well, I'm such a drag on the family right now that they'd be better off without me.
Oh, and right. Yeah.
And that it's hard to get past. You can't rationalize someone in that
you're
position.
Right.
Yeah. All you can do is sit with them until, I mean, the feeling will pass if they have someone with them, but you can't know that. And I don't think anyone who's a friend or survivor should ever blame themselves.
Yeah, no. And and you shouldn't. And, you know, the whole point of this discussion is that, you know, it's a very complex topic and it hits everyone individually and it hits deep. And I think it should hit people deep to when this happens. It's not a news item. It's a human being.
That's right.
And both of you have expressed that beautifully. And I thank you for that. Okay. So it's predictions time. And you get to make one prediction as to what you think happens next in this world that is profound. And I'm going to start with Kelly. You got 30 seconds. What do you think is the big prediction from Kelly's view of the world?
I'm going to stick with my prediction I made before, and I think that the summit with North Korea is going to end up being a very positive one. And I don't know when, you know, I'm not saying this summit coming up, we're going to, you know, tie it in a bow. But I think with our relationship with North Korea, it's going to end up being a quiet one.
Ah, there you go. And Jennifer, your big prediction?
My prediction is that off of the recent success that Kim Kardashian has had with justice reform, that she's going to become a big voice in that space, and she and Kanye and Trump will be a force to be reckoned with.
Ah, I like that prediction.
That was good.
Yeah, that's a very good one. Yeah, and you know, so, and with that, mazel tov.